Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the show. This is Reservations, and I'm Jeremy Blair.
And I'm Ryan Wayland. So, Jeremy, do you think we should acknowledge the elephant in the room?
Yeah, you're R. Kelly trapped in the closet, man.
I am. to those of you watching, listening, hopefully I sound great. To those of you watching, I'm in my wife's closet. We have some guests, Alex and his wife Emily, and their three daughters are hanging out. And we needed to do this, and so I told them, sorry, I have to be a very bad host. I will be in the closet if you need me. And they kind of looked at me like,
honestly, I was wondering why it took you so long to set up. I was like, wow, it's taking him so long.
Well, and also, yeah. I was eating. We had little Caesars, you know.
Okay.
I have to hold my mic for this. So that's another reason why I sound good.
Yeah. You sound
fine. But if anyone's wondering why I'm surrounded by clothes, no, I'm not stuck at like a Goodwill or something like that.
Because trapped in a Goodwill.
Because I love my wife and I love her clothes, but you know she does have a very mixed clothing style. Like I'm sitting in between her dresses and then like her like school shirts.
So she has her own closet.
Yeah,
you guys.
I have my own closet.
You guys are doing very well. Haley and I have share a closet.
Well, see, Ashley has the only walk-in closet. That's why I'm able to be inside of it. Yeah. Mine has a sliding door on it. So technically I could be in my closet.
I see.
But then no one would see me.
I see. So. Okay. I see what you're saying. So there's a slidey deal and then there's a walk-in. Okay. Yeah. Again, you guys are doing very well.
And Ashley got the walk-in. She got the better deal.
I once I don't remember if it was Kale who told me this or if I saw the stand-up special, but I heard a comedian say, I was in an elevator recently because I have the money. And that makes me laugh. I don't know, it's just that shit makes me laugh. Anyway.
Yeah.
So
but yeah, congrats. So next week it'll be normal back in front of the bookshelf.
Yep.
But you know, Jeremy, before we get started, we have something new that I might want to try.
Go ahead.
Talking about movies for 4 years, we've never actually had the opportunity to promote a movie that's coming out.
No.
And by association, we know the director of the movie.
Which is exciting.
Yeah. So, everyone, my mom, one of her best friends is a lady named Marion Yeager. She is an independent filmmaker based out of Austin. And she has a movie coming out August 11th. We're super excited for it.
What's the movie called, right?
Oh, sorry. I'm doing a terrible job. I've never promoted a movie before.
That's okay. I haven't either.
The movie is called Match Me If You Can. It is written by Betsy Morris. She's written some other movies before. One, I believe it's called, I don't remember what it's called, but it has Jensen Ackles in it. But
Tenant Hero.
That's it. Yeah. Betsy wrote Tenant Hero. Mm-hmm. So she wrote this movie as well. Marion directed it. It is a cute, laugh out loud rom-com about finding love in this new digital age that we're in.
Yeah. You know, I mean, it would speak to, you know, to people like me who, before I met my wife, I was on all those sites and it was like, it's torture. It's torture to be on those sites, mm-hmm. by the way. So, but I saw the trailer, looks hilarious. It's cute. It's quirky. It's fun. It's light. I love it. It's going to be fun for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
And dude, kudos. But listen, a few years ago, we visited that movie set. Do you remember that?
I do.
It seems impossible when you're there that a movie gets made. Okay. Mm-hmm. When you're there and you're watching the process, would you quit that? Sorry, it's my cats. If when you're sitting there watching it happen, you're like, how can you keep any of this straight in your head? Right. How mm-hmm. can you do it? So for anyone to make a film is an insurmountable feat, an achievement. And so it's amazing. So kudos to Marion. It looks fun. It looks awesome. I'm super happy for you, man. I mean, it looks great.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, what's even crazier is it showed up on Entertainment Weekly's must watch films of the summer, I believe.
Really?
So, yeah. Excuse me. So, again, everyone, the movie is premiering August 11th in select theaters, but also on, I didn't get an exact list, but some of the major streaming platforms. And cool. You can pre-order it on iTunes right this second.
Right now.
Yeah. So.
Awesome. Match me if you can. Yeah. August 11th. Go check it out.
Yeah. And, you know, support an independent filmmaker.
Definitely.
Because they aren't the scabs.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, it's super exciting. Again, I mean, she's living the dream, you know, getting to make movies, you know.
Absolutely.
It's cool that your mom is – it's kind of like, you know, how my Uncle Roy is best friends with Randy Cordray, who produced The Office for years and years.
Yeah.
He actually – those of you who – I don't even know if I've ever told this story on the show.
I think you might have, because I remember your mom commenting on that video.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. So I mentioned Randy. But yeah, so it's cool to, you know, sort of be close to the industry like that, you know, like something that we love so much. And then, you know, we're pretty – by transitive properties, we're pretty close.
Yeah. Well,
you know, so than me.
Yeah. More so. Marion, if you're listening, hi. I actually got to visit one of Marion's sets years and years and years ago.
No.
She was making a short film called This Good Samaritan, I believe. And mom's actually in it. So
no.
Yeah.
Shout out to Mickey. Good job.
Yeah. So again, everyone, check out Match Me If You Can, August 11th. And Jeremy, what are we talking about today, buddy?
Dude. It's end of season series time.
End of season series.
So, like I said last week, I loved doing the stage to screen series we did a few years ago, where we talk about films that are originally plays and adapted into film. This one was a book, then adapted to a play, then adapted to a film. So it's a whole bunch of stuff. And we are kicking off this series this season with One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
I was just going to say, you know, this was a first watch for me. Like I mentioned last week, I was so close to seeing this movie many times, but I just never got around to it. Mostly because I didn't know what it was. You know, I didn't have my appreciation for film like I had now. Like I mentioned last week, my grandparents had like this collector's edition, or I wouldn't say collector's edition. The more I've been thinking about it, I think it was just an anniversary edition of the film. And I just remember seeing the cover, which hopefully Future Rain has put the one up by now, of Jack Nicholson. And I was like, what is this movie? Cause I knew who Jack Nicholson was by that point, but I was like, what is this? And honestly, bro, I loved it.
Yeah.
Absolutely loved it. Ashley watched it with me. I was like, do you want to watch this with me? And tell me you're proud of me. I watched it early. We watched it watched it on Friday.
Oh, so did I.
Nice.
Nice.
First time, I think, in a while I've watched a movie ahead of schedule instead of cramming it in last minute. So do you remember... I know I've asked you this before, but do you remember the first time you saw this movie?
No, I don't. It was probably when I was in high school, maybe, or it was shortly after I graduated. It's been a while since I've seen it for the first time. And I saw it. you know, immediately, I mean, as a viewer, you just gravitate towards McMurphy and you're like, who is this person? Why he's so captivating. Right. And, you know, then of course, by that time, of course, I knew who Christopher Lloyd was and I was like, oh my God, it's his first movie. You know, this, he looks so young and yet the same. Right. Danny DeVito, I knew already too. And so that was cool to see him be very young and not look the same. And so that was cool. I loved the idea of this guy just coming in and sort of causing chaos in this already chaotic environment not very chaotic. And we'll get to that in this asylum or whatever, mental hospital. And of course, I just loved the ending, right? I love Chief. And I hated Nurse Ratched. And that's sort of how you're supposed to be, you know? You hate her so much. Those I remember. Of course, through multiple viewings, you get more and more stuff out of it, right? This time around, I noticed like, oh, McMurphy's not a good person, you know, like the reason he's in there in the first place, you're like, ooh.
Yeah.
You know,
dude, when
I don't think I've ever noticed that.
Yeah. When the doctor's going through his rap sheet, Ashley and I looked at each other like,
yikes.
Oh boy.
You know?
Yeah. Before we get too off topic, let me give everyone just a quick synopsis. So One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest stars Jack Nicholson as P.T. McMurphy.
Sure. Oh no, sure. Patrick is his middle name. So James Patrick McMurphy?
J.P. McMurphy, who is the newest patient of this local mental institution. And they're mainly there to see if he's actually as crazy as he claims he is. And through a series of events, he just kind of weasels his way into the hearts and minds of the fellow patients, literally inspiring them to want more out of their life, you know, at the asylum. And it's, you know, to someone like you and I, it seems very basic, like, you know, to take them fishing. But, you know, that's probably something they haven't gotten to do in years. And we'll get to it. But that definitely, I would say, is the moment everyone's life starts to change. And they really gravitate to McMurphy as a leader. Lost my train of thought. Sorry. But unfortunately, McMurphy is the undoing of his own self-interest. His wants and needs get too great, like bringing his girlfriend Candy and her friend into the hospital, wanting to throw a rager, and it just all culminates in honestly one of the most insane 15 minutes of a film we've done in quite a while. And it has kind of a downer ending, but also a triumphant one at the same time. I don't want to talk about it just yet, cause I want to wait till the end. Mm-hmm. But that's One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Cool. Yep.
So I'm assuming you'd like to begin with McMurphy.
Yeah. So of course, right. McMurphy is our hero, as it were. Cause he's not very heroic, nor is he a good person. We briefly touched on that. He's not awesome. But what he represents, in this story is chaos and sort of liberation, right? That's what he represents in this story, right? In sort of order and You wouldn't really want to, you know, say that, you know, they're being, you know, like persecuted or anything. These patients are just victims of order, right?
Right.
And right. Yeah. Peace and order. That's what the hospital is, right? And then here comes mm-hmm. McMurphy. So what's cool is I saw this video. I should probably try to find it so I can tell you who it was. But and I loved it. It was an amazing little video essay about One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And I loved how they said that, you know, the film doesn't open with McMurphy immediately going to the hospital. It opens on this this big landscape, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because McMurphy is like a wild animal. He's from the wilderness, right? And the music with the tribal drums and the, you know, that sort of is representing sort of his one with nature and one with you know, with the chaos of wilderness, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so when he comes in, here's what's fascinating. So I don't know if you even picked up on this, but the music transitions in such a unique way that once the music and the drums fade out, a ticking clock begins, right? When Nurse Ratched enters the hospital, and because she is the representation of organization, order, right? And keeping people in line, right?
Okay.
And of course, McMurphy comes in, and even in wardrobe, just stands out from everybody else, right? Everyone else is in white, or in, you know, the patients are in that cream colored scrub, and you know, he's in his brown leather jacket and in his black beanie, and or some would say toboggan, perhaps, depending on where you're from. And immediately causes chaos. He's stirring the pot as soon as he walks in, right?
Yep.
It was his idea to do the Native American war dance for Chief when he meets Chief for the first time.
Oh God. You know, I'm not gonna lie, when that came up, I was like, oh, I hope this man, the actor who plays Chief, wasn't offended by that. I don't think so either. Considering the fact he was a park ranger when they hired him to be Chief. So I don't think he was offended. And I'm sure he was more like, oh my God, that's Jack Nicholson.
Exactly. I mean, Jack Nicholson's a huge star at this point.
Yeah.
But here's what's interesting. So I want to make this comparison before we keep moving forward.
Okay.
Because besides their character, as in who they are as people, mm-hmm. which is going to be very different. So besides who they are as individuals, their impact on their surroundings and who they are in relation to or how they affect the people they're around and the position they're put in, I would say this film sort of pays a lot of debt to Cool Hand Luke. Okay.
Okay. Okay.
You
know what?
What's up?
I was going to say, as soon as you said that, I was like, yes.
Right. Because you have this outsider coming into this, this place, and they are stirring the pot, shaking things up, bringing hope and disorder and sort of levity to a place full of despair, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in strict order. And so I would make that comparison before we move on.
That makes a lot of sense. I mean,
just in case people want something else to grasp onto while we're talking about this stuff, just think about it. If you've seen Cool Hand Luke, by the way, we've done an episode on it. Go check that out.
Shout out to our boy Keegan. Yep, his favorite movie.
That's right. And that might help you sort of piece together sort of who I think McMurphy is in this scenario, right?
Yeah, you know, and that is such a fantastic comparison, dude, because, you know, maybe if someone doesn't want to ever see this movie, which we would highly recommend it.
Oh, absolutely.
I think Cool Hand Luke is a perfect, it's perfect for that. Like if you want a similar story, but maybe mental illness isn't your bag, or you don't like Jack Nicholson, which is a travesty. go watch Cool Hand Luke and then listen to our episode about it.
And again, who they are as people is completely different, because McMurphy is a bad guy. Okay.
Oh, 100%.
Now, here's what's also interesting. Before we keep moving on with McMurphy, the book is not through McMurphy's point of view. Okay. I read this yesterday or today that it's through Chief's point of view.
Oh.
That Chief is the one that's sort of telling us the story, which is fascinating. Okay. But if I did read that correctly. However, so the author was, of course, very upset that they changed up sort of the themes and the point of view and the overall, plot elements of the story, because having an outside view of McMurphy is different than having McMurphy's point of view, right?
Right. But I do find that interesting, because the whole time I was watching it, I felt like yes, obviously, because it's Jack Nicholson, McMurphy is front and center.
Yeah.
But I was feeling more like we were getting it more from Billy's perspective, which I want to dedicate a lot of time to Billy. Fucking love Brad Dourif. He is definitely awesome. But that's interesting. And of course, I could understand why the author would be upset, especially if, you know, that's how it was written. But I mean, at the same time, they cast Jack Nicholson as McMurphy.
Yeah,
he's got to be front and center.
Yeah, and so I found that very interesting. That I wonder what this movie would be like if it was through his eyes, or even what that would look like, right?
Right.
Because it would need to be. Like, we couldn't see a lot of the stuff we saw because Chief wasn't there. You know what I mean? Unless Chief heard it from someone else. And I think that, you know, especially at the end, but I think around near, you know, the middle to maybe the last, you know, fourth of the movie, the third of the movie, then we do get a lot of Chief and we do get a lot of his perspective. So I don't think a lot of it's missing. I mean, a lot of it is missing, but I don't think it's all gone, right? So
I agree. It definitely seems like when we first hear Chief speak is when we get more of his perspective.
I mean, and you learn so much in just those few seconds that you're like, you know, he's not stupid. That's number one, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's not crazy. That's number two, right? Mm-hmm. And now it's just like, well, then who is this guy? Why is he there? Why is he trying to trick everyone? You know, it's fascinating. But we'll get into more Chief later. But
absolutely.
But now, as McMurphy is our sort of anti-hero protagonist, we have, of course, our antagonist, which is Nurse Ratched.
Hang on. I don't want to butcher her name. I know her first name is Louise.
It's Fletcher.
I was like, it's Louise Fletcher, but my brain's like, to be honest, bro, my brain's been kind of scaring me today. I had to call a customer and I stuttered through the word fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
I was trying to say, and I hope you have a fantastic day. And I went, fantastic. And it scared the shit out of me, if I'm being honest. I've never done that in my life. So I knew it was Louise Fletcher, but I was like, no, doesn't sound right.
Next time you do it, next time you stutter, can you just to yourself, just to make yourself laugh, can you go, wow, what a terrific audience? South Park.
And then, anyway, and then they think I am crazy.
Yeah.
But yes, Nurse Ratched. You know, again, this was the first watch for me. And of course, obviously, you know, everyone knows who Nurse Ratched is, even before Ryan Murphy decided to make that awful show.
Didn't see it.
Which, as Ashley and I were watching the movie, I found out apparently that show got a 2-season order from Netflix. But Sarah Paulson has said she has no idea when season 2 is going to start. And I'm like, hopefully fucking never. Because Ryan Murphy's out of ideas.
That's true.
Anyway, but I'd always seen Nurse Ratched show up on, like, you know, some of the greatest cinema villains, you know, up there with Darth Vader. And I'm like, a nurse, really? And then I saw and then after finishing the movie on Friday, I was like, oh, yeah, she's almost as bad as Darth Vader.
Now, I will say that,
okay,
yes, she's horrible, evil, nasty, terrible. Mm-hmm. But I don't think she gets to that point until we're like 20 minutes in, or to 20 minutes till it's done. Right.
I agree. I would say hers is much more subtle. She's very subtle with and deliberate with exactly how she speaks to the patients. And, like when Cheswick, you know, harps on her, like, why are you grilling Billy so hard? Like, why are you doing that? Because he's at least recognizing that she is being a little bit too, you know, poking the bear a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, one could argue, well, that's her job. She's the nurse running the therapy group. But some of those questions, especially about Billy's mom, which I love that Milos Forman puts that in there.
Yeah.
And that's our first clue. So that's Billy's trigger. I was already like, she's not asking the right questions here. I think that's what makes her so sinister, is that, because you're right. Last 20 minutes of the movie is when we really see how evil and sadistic she really is. Mm-hmm. But throughout the rest of the movie, it's just so subtle and so deliberate and it's just.
I agree, because, oh, here's Haley. Hi, honey.
Hey.
Hi, Haley.
Hey.
Say hi to the world.
Hi, world.
Zach.
Yeah, Zach. Sorry, my wife just came in. But what's so fascinating about it is because up until that point, when she finally has that, you know, she berates Billy after the party and breaks him down to nothing, right? Up until then, you could argue that she really does just wants what's best for the patients, right? And she really is trying to help these patients, even though she is very, very militaristic, very strict, right? She's still wanting the best. But once she does that, you're like, no. You know what she wants? She wants control.
Mm-hmm.
And
absolutely.
As soon as McMurphy comes through that door, now we have a struggle to see who's going to win control over the ward, over the patients. Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. I read that Louise Fletcher said that she wanted to humanize Nurse Ratched, which, fantastic on her, because yes, she's a villain, but she is very humanized, you know, because I agree. I think somewhere deep down behind the recesses of she wants control, she thinks what she is doing is the best for these patients.
Mm-hmm.
Like, some part of her does care for these patients, but it's being controlled by this need of I have all the power.
Yeah.
I'm in control. And and I think, and again, it goes back to her being so subtle with everything.
Yeah. Yeah. It's she loves having the power and control over the ward and over the patients. And as soon as that's threatened, you know, she almost has to kick it in over. Sorry, my cat just jumped on my lap. She has to sort of kick it in overdrive, right? And and sort of find new ways to keep control, and is sort of struggling to hold on to it, that she'll do whatever it takes, right? Which in some cases can be breaking these poor men down to nothing, or to shock McMurphy into submission, and even that doesn't work, right?
Right.
Not until she has him lobotomized. Ugh, sorry, spoilers for the end.
Oh no, spoilers for this almost 40-year-old movie.
And so, you know, that's this whole movie is just to fight for control, right? Fight for power. And,
absolutely.
And, you know, it's amazing that, like, McMurphy, in contrast with Ratchet. So Ratchet gets a little more sadistic as the movie goes along. She gets more vengeful, more mean, right? To put it in like a stupid basic term. But McMurphy becomes more caring and compassionate as the movie goes along. He tends to really care for these men that he's stuck there with, right? And then of course that makes the ending more tragic because, you know, yes, he wasn't really crazy and he pled insanity just to get out of going back to prison, but he did end up in some weird way being rehabilitated, right? He was getting that rehabilitation that he was trying to fight, right?
Right. Yeah. But, you know, going back to the struggle of control between McMurphy and Ratchet, you know, I did start to think, I was like, you know, someone's going to get caught in the crossfire here. And I felt like the film did such a great job of, it could have been anyone, you know, it could have been Christopher Lloyd, which, dude, I told Ashley, I was like, isn't it wild? This is his film debut. And then 10 years later, he'll be in one of the biggest and most iconic 80s movies ever.
Yeah. And even before that, he and
DeVito
would be in Taxi together, right?
Yep. Yep. I actually just recently watched Danny DeVito's GQ interview, and first movie he talked about was this. And I learned apparently he played Martini on an off-Broadway version before the movie went into production.
And which I was like, it's also how he met Rhea Perlman.
Ah.
Isn't that crazy? Perlman.
Dude, shout out to Rhea Perlman. She was, in my opinion, one of the best. Like, there were many best parts of Barbie, but as soon as she came on screen, I was like, oh.
Yeah, shout out to Rhea Perlman, for sure.
Shout out to Rhea Perlman. but anyway, so my point being is that I thought for sure it was going to be, I knew someone was going to get caught in the crossfire in some form or fashion. My money was on Cheswick. I thought for sure it was going to be Cheswick. Mm-hmm. But because, like I said, I did want to dedicate time. It's poor Billy.
Yeah.
And dude, that besides the ending itself, that hurt me so much, because we spend so much time with Billy, you know, getting to know he's one of the more kind of put together patients, because he kind of is. I mean, besides his really bad stammer,
You know, and he's also voluntary, right? So he's not there. Well, hold on now. I take that back, because he says he's voluntary, but really, I'm sure he's been manipulated by his mother and Nurse Ratchet, who are friends, to make him believe he is voluntary and there by choice. But really, I don't believe that. I take it back immediately. As soon as I said it, because that's not true. But you're right, because I think what makes Billy's death so horrible is because his gain of confidence in how McMurphy helps him find himself, right? And his character arc is very positive and I don't know, and I wouldn't say, you know, joyous, but I mean, it's, you know, sort of this upbeat and uplifting part of the film, and then it's taken all away.
Yeah. In in like 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Like I said, I love Brad Dourif. I think he's a phenomenal character actor. Shout out to Twin Towers when we meet Grima Wormtongue.
Yep.
And you know, of course, to everyone out there who's a Child's Play fan, you know, he's the voice of Chucky.
And Deadwood fans. He's the doc. Yes. Deadwood. So.
Oh, and he's in our Lord and Savior David Lynch's adaptation of Dune.
That's right.
So as soon as he came on screen, you know, I'm all in on Billy.
Yeah.
And I would say, if anything, you know, Billy maybe falls in love too quickly, you know, as we learn during his grilling session, you know. But yeah, his death was probably the most awful part of the movie.
Mm-hmm, definitely.
Because like you said, Nurse Ratched just breaks him down, especially after we see this confidence. You know, he's not stuttering anymore. He's not stammering. He is kind of, in a way, standing up to Nurse Ratched, you know. I'm not ashamed. But as soon as she says, well, what would your mother think? It regresses him. Mm-hmm. And he pleads with her, well, just don't tell my mom. And then that's when we get the, well, you know, your mother and I are good friends. And I was like, oh, you fucking bitch.
Fucking bitch.
And then literally 3-4 minutes later, we see that he's killed himself. It is the most horrible part of the whole movie.
I think so, because even McMurphy's fate at the end, right? Mm-hmm. Isn't as tragic because, well, we'll get to it, but it's not as tragic. Billy's death is just tragic, right? Yeah. It's heartbreaking, like you said. I mean, it's awful. And even Louise Fletcher, she said that she couldn't watch One Flew Over. She couldn't watch the movie. She's like, I'm too horrible in it. She's Nurse Ratched is horrible. And she's like, I can't. It's awful to watch. And she would even like, poor Louise Fletcher. So she felt as if like I was reading that she felt like so envious and so angry that the rest of the cast was so close and was joking around and laughing and having a good time. And so there was one day where she did one of her scenes in just her underwear to show that she was cool and loose too, you know?
Look at me, guys. I'm cool. Let me in your gang.
So that's something that's super interesting and something that that we could talk about for a second, because it's like a real phenomenon that I've read about, because I've never, you know, had any firsthand experience, but it's really sad when this happens. Lou Ferrigno, who is the Incredible Hulk, said he used to struggle on the set of that show because when he was in his makeup, no one wanted to talk to him.
Really?
No one wanted to hang out with him. Yeah. And so it's sort of like you play this person on set, and then of course, you know, because they're either staying in character, which a lot of the cast did, which drove Jack Nicholson insane. And so you're, of course, going to separate yourself from the antagonist, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or you're just so used to this person being horrible all day that you don't want to hang out. You're already making negative associations with this person because they're playing a part very well, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's almost reminiscent. I remember when I read this, I thought it was kind of funny, but also in retrospect, kind of sad. It's like what Joe Pesci did on Home Alone, where he intentionally stayed away from Macaulay Culkin to have this air of mystery.
Yeah.
And this, you know, I'm not a good guy. And yeah, he's not. He's a good fella.
Stupid.
But no, I 100% agree with what you're saying, man. Like, it is crazy. And I'm sure that affects the actual person's psyche as well.
It does. Again, she was like super mad. You know, she was mad and envious that people could like sit around and have a good time, and she can't do that, right? Because people are kind of either staying away from her, or she felt like she was isolated from everyone because she's the villain and everyone else are just victims, right? And but what's funny is, you know, we've talked about it before on the show, I'm sure. One of my favorite stories about Jack Nicholson is on the set of A Few Good Men, which is a phenomenal film, which could have been a contender for this season, end of season series, because it's based on a play written by Aaron Sorkin.
That's, of course, that's why you love it.
I know. But there, I think it's Kevin Pollak tells a story. He's in the movie. He's also a stand-up comedian. He tells a story that, you know, during the "Did you order the code red" scene, I mean, Jack Nicholson has this ferociousness to him in the scene, and he's screaming, and you know, he's so vicious and angry. And as soon as they called cut, he went from that to just leaning back, going, you know, just all smiles, just goofy, like, "Something, how you doing?" You know.
I was in the Batman.
Which to me is, and I mean, I know there are several ways to do something, but to me, that's a sign of a truly talented actor who can just turn it off. Right.
Absolutely. You know, we kind of touched on it a little bit last week, you know, with Jared Leto going full method for a children's film.
Ridiculous.
And like, look, you know, I know we have our different views on method acting, and hang on, everyone, we'll get back to One Flew Over. I think if method acting is done well and controlled, and you don't go, you know, you're not being this person in your day-to-day life, I think it's fine. You know, obviously, like Marlon Brando, for instance, very famous case of method acting. It, let's be honest, literally drove him crazy. But I think Nicholson is one of those. I think he's the method acting that I think of, because he's in it, like with A Few Good Men. Like, that's one of the most iconic scenes in a lot of film. And just knowing that as soon as they called cut, he's like, "All right, great take, guys. That was awesome."
Just back to Jack, right? And so during this movie, he would see these actors, you know, staying in character, and it that drove him crazy. He was like, "Well, I can't have a conversation with anybody," you know?
Well, and I think I get that because, you know, Christopher Lloyd, for instance, as we talked about in our back, the first time we, you know, was the catalyst for how the show is now with Back to the Future. Christopher Lloyd was a theater actor, and, you know, those guys stay in character all the time. And so I'm sure for him transitioning to film, he was like, "Well, I've got to stay in character. Right. I have to." And so him, I could see. Some of the other actors, Brad Dourif, maybe. This was also his film debut as well. So him, I could kind of see well.
They're babies.
Yeah. So I could see why that would drive Jack crazy, especially because, as we mentioned, by this point, he's a massive star, you know, and he hasn't even done Batman yet, you know, obviously. You know, he's so I could see why that would drive him crazy, but it does kind of make me laugh a little bit that that essentially there are these method actors and he's like, "Oh my God, stop."
But these, but again, speaking of like the behind the scenes, like the scene where, and we can, now we can transfer into the ending. So when McMurphy is lobotomized and Chief goes to see him, right? We haven't even talked about Chief. We need to do that in a minute. Sorry, but when he's
here, let's press pause on the ending and let's talk about Chief.
All right, fine.
Yeah.
So Chief is fascinating because he subverts our expectations, of course.
Of course. I knew that he did talk. I had seen some analysis of this film, so I knew he talked. So I was kind of like, I thought he talked, And so I thought I was Mandela affecting myself.
Yeah.
Cause he is sort of this enigma that we don't know a lot about.
So what my sort of reading and analysis of Chief is Chief is doing what McMurphy is doing, but quietly and for himself, right? So Okay. Where McMurphy wants to create this chaos and disorder and shake things up and sort of be in this place, escape from where he's trying to escape from, which is prison, and sort of, you know, make it his own, like have his cake and eat it too. That's what McMurphy wants, right? And Chief knows he's not crazy, right? At least that's my interpretation, that he's not crazy. Chief knows that to maintain his sort of isolation from everyone and to sort of stay under the radar, let's pretend, you know, to be this, you know, deaf mute to where people leave you alone too, right? Mm-hmm. Knowing full well that he has full, you know, he can hear and he can speak, right? And,
you know, I just had this thought about Chief. Kind of what we've been talking about, this power of control. Mm-hmm. It's almost like Chief knows that this is the one thing that they can't control on him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just a thought.
No, you're right. I think that he is himself taking control of his own situation by having this secret. And, you know, if people think that you're deaf and mute, you know, they're not gonna, you know, you don't have to go to therapy, right? Yeah. You're sort of left alone. And I don't know why he's there. I don't know if he's voluntary. I don't know if he was court ordered to be there. I don't know anything about Chief, but I know that he's there because he chooses to be, because as we see with the ending, and again, we'll get there, that he can leave anytime he wants. Or you could argue that he was put there, chose very quickly to do this ruse, right?
Mm-hmm.
To pretend to be deaf and mute, to get by and to be left alone. And McMurphy gave him the confidence and showed him that you can be free, you can escape, right? That this place doesn't have to hold you down.
I agree. You know, because Chief, like I said, Chief is sort of like an enigma. Like you said, we don't know why he's there. We don't know if it's voluntary or court ordered, whatever. And honestly, by the end of the movie, I don't want to know those answers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, especially considering, you know, which is leading up to the transition, but you know, how the movie ends, it ends very triumphantly for Chief.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't need to know why he's there, but I do find it very interesting that, not interesting, actually, I find it very funny that the thing that finally got him to talk was McMurphy sharing some of his juicy fruit gum with him. And I just love like a kid on Christmas, McMurphy's like, you sly son of a bitch, you can talk.
Yeah, I mean, if we titled these episodes the way we normally do, this would have been titled You Fooled Them All, you know?
Yeah.
Chief is such a fascinating character because, again, he did fool everybody, and you can guess at his motivations of why he did it, which I think I got, you know, like he just wants to be left alone. Yep. And he wants to maintain his level of his isolation. And, you know, he's now an observer, right?
Right.
If you're in control of your surroundings, if you can observe everything and be left alone to do so, right?
Right. I agree.
And when he meets McMurphy is you know, this unicorn of a person coming in and just, you know, changing everything he knows about, you know, life in this mental institution, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And because normally people who come in there are actually crazy, or, I mean, that's obviously an outdated term.
Need help.
Right.
Yeah.
McMurphy, of course, not, I mean, he does need help, but not that kind. And, yeah. And again, you know, the progression of this, you think that when McMurphy gets there, you think, you know, he's sort of just going to be mean to everyone and sort of not give a shit and sort of just try to, you know, force his way into doing whatever he wants, no matter the cost of anyone. Right. Mm-hmm. You kind of see that with the basketball game, stuff like that. He's just trying to have fun for himself. But eventually, like I was saying before, he does end up getting this sort of caring and compassion for his fellow ward mates. And of course he makes a big, strong bond with Chief. And it was even before Chief spoke, he was already making that bond with him. And as soon as they spoke, they're both these disruptors in this institution. They're both fooling everyone, or they're both sort of being anarchists in this place. Which makes them kindred spirits. Right?
Mm-hmm. Which, good transition, brings us to the second most devastating part of this movie. As you mentioned, when Chief visits McMurphy after he's come back from being lobotomized, it's interesting that that's what happens to McMurphy, especially considering, you know, he's in a place where they're there to help the brain, and they lobotomize him, which takes his ability to be himself away.
Yeah.
Because they knew that was the only way they could stop him.
Well, right, of course, right? They know. I mean, everyone at that meeting after they went fishing knows that he's not crazy, you know?
Yeah.
And that he's not mentally – that he is of sound mind, right? They know that he's fine.
Right.
And so from there, of course, the reason why they just don't send him to prison is Ratchet wants to devour him, right? She wants to win. If he leaves, she doesn't win, right?
Yep.
And so, but of course, ironically, what McMurphy has done by being lobotomized is he has fully lifted the veil, has taken the masks, eye masks off of everyone, taking the blindfolds off of everyone. They can finally see who Nurse Ratchet is for who she is, right? And it was all because he pushed Nurse Ratchet to the breaking point to where she revealed who she was, right? And punished McMurphy to the fullest extent she could. And of course, in doing so, undid her completely, right? He becomes what Cool Hand Luke becomes, which is this sort of quasi Christ figure, this martyr, to these people of the ward, right?
Yep.
He might as well have eaten 50 eggs and laid on a table, you know?
Right. that's really good. Cause the Christ imagery in that film is blatant. But you know, and we have this really, I really love the moment with Chief and the now brain dead McMurphy, where Chief isn't ready to let go. And he's like, no, you're coming with me. Cause you're right. They have essentially imprinted on one another, and they are kindred spirits, and Chief's not, he's not ready to let McMurphy go.
Right.
Even though he knows the McMurphy he knew is dead. And I think that's why he decides to mercy kill him, because he knows deep down that if McMurphy was really in there, you know, he wouldn't want to live like this.
No, of course not. Right. He wouldn't want to stay in that place like that for the rest of his life. That's not McMurphy. Right. And so McMurphy would rather die. And Chief knows that. Right. Louise Fletcher was there that day on set and she had to leave.
Because it was that traumatic.
Yeah, it was, she said it was so horrible. I couldn't watch it. And she had to like be told to leave, cause she was like making noise and she was like hysterical. Yeah. So, I mean, again, very powerful, right? Because McMurphy has now successfully and fully sacrificed himself for the good of these people to show them what living really is. Like, these people aren't living, right? And then, of course, we get the famous Chief escape, where he lifts that the water thing.
The pressure gauge, I think.
And then breaks the window and escapes. By the way, Jack Nicholson really did try to pull it in that scene where he's trying to lift up the water hose tower. And he has scrapes all over his arms because he actually did try to lift it. Bolted to the ground. Like, he's not going to be able to lift it.
Well, and I just love what he says when he walks out. I tried, God damn it. And see, and now that you've said that he legitimately tried, that makes me feel like he actually was like actually saying that. Yeah. Like, yeah.
But again, it's triumphant, right? It's this big crescendo of an ending where Chief finally he lifts it, and he was doing what McMurphy was unable to do, right?
Yep.
But yet without McMurphy, he would have never done it in the first place.
Yep, because McMurphy made him feel as big as a damn mountain.
Boom. Yeah.
Yep.
This movie's fucking great.
Yeah, this movie is phenomenal. No wonder, as you said last week, it won the Big Five.
And I do have a list, by the way, of the other two movies that have done this.
Well, besides Everything Everywhere All at Once.
Right.
What was the other one?
It Happened One Night. 1934, and The Silence of the Lambs, 1991.
Oh shit, man! Shout out to Silence of the Lambs. Go listen to our episode on
that. Oh yeah, we did it. Sometimes I forget.
But yeah, man, this movie is fantastic. You know, I love the fact that this movie also kind of set the stage for, you know, a lot of these actors: Christopher Lloyd, Brad Dourif, Danny DeVito, you know.
Yeah.
And it's one of those special 70s movies that knock on wood, can never be remade, because it's perfect the way it is.
I agree. 100%. If you even tried to remake it, I would be, you know, it's impossible.
The only way I could see them remaking it is if they did a true adaptation of the book. That's the only thing I could see.
Maybe, you know, but I mean, it'd still be trash.
Yeah. It wouldn't have Nicholson in it.
That's right. It wouldn't have Nicholson.
But Jeremy, are you ready to wrap up?
I am. This movie's incredible. Everyone should see it. Milos Forman, also just incredible as a filmmaker. Go check out Amadeus. Go check out Man on the Moon.
Oh my God, that's right. You did do Man on the Moon. Dude, that's a future episode for sure. I fucking love that movie.
Yeah. Yeah. It's good, man. Milos Forman's great, man. So yeah, go check out all the stuff.
I have a quick oops, I forgot. And then we can do the thing you wanted to tell everyone before we get to our tease. Oops, I forgot. I didn't know Scatman Crothers was in this. And I leaned over to Ashley.
You're right. God damn it.
And I leaned over Scatman to Ashley and was like, hey, 5 years later, Jack Nicholson is going to kill him.
That's right. Going to stick an axe in his stomach. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Even Crothers. Ashley was like, she was like, is that Dick Halloran? I was like, good job. It is.
Is Dick Halloran. Yes. Scatman Crothers makes a great cameo. In this, I wish he was in the entire thing.
Oh no, dude! He and Nicholson, I pray that when they did The Shining together, that they're because they have such great chemistry together. But anyway, so Jeremy, you told me that you had a quick little announcement you'd like to tell everyone.
Before we move on to next week, which I'm very excited about. Tragic news today. So when we did, and it even ties into last time we did From Stage to Screen, because we did Bug, which is an adaptation of the Tracy Letts play, but it was directed by William Friedkin, and William Friedkin passed away today. 87 years old. He directed The Exorcist, which is said to be, you know, the greatest horror film of all time.
Now we're going to ruin it with a spinoff.
We'll see. We'll see. The show was amazing on Fox.
The movie's being directed by David Gordon Green.
I know. But,
and like, look, he's decent as a director, but he ran the Halloween franchise into the ground.
Back to the ground where it was. It where he found it. But William Friedkin, tremendous filmmaker, also did Killer Joe. Which is another adaptation of a Tracy Letts play, which was on the list, by the way. So I had done this list, Killer Joe was on it, and I took it off for something else. So maybe one day we'll do Killer Joe because I really like that one. Also,
Screen Act 3.
Oh, yep, that's true. To Live and Die in L.A., another William Friedkin film. So The French Connection. So he'll be missed. Tremendous filmmaker. It's sad to see him go, but at least we can celebrate his life through his work. So
absolutely, so a good transition. So buddy, what is going to be part two of our end of season series?
I hope you guys like swearing. I know I do. So next week we are discussing David Mamet's adaptation of his own play, Glengarry Glen Ross.
So this is going to be another first timer for me. All I know is Alec Baldwin is in it.
Yep.
The only other thing about this movie I know is the joke that that Kevin Smith makes and Zach and Mary make a porno. which is Justin Long's character is a gay porn star. Mm-hmm. And he's talking about how he's hinting at it with Seth Rogen's character. He's not full on saying it. He's like, oh, I'm in all male reproductions of films. Like, and he's like, oh, like Glengarry Glen Ross. And he's like, more like Glenn and Gary drop their hairy balls in Ross's mouth.
Oh my God.
And that's all I know.
So this movie is maybe one of the most rewatchable movies I've ever seen. Okay. It's the language of the film is just tremendous. Like I mean the way David Mamet writes is just truly awesome. The acting, of course, is it's A1, you know. I'm sure we've done a movie with Jack Lemmon in it.
No, we haven't.
No? Anyway, Jack Lemmon's in this.
Dude, shout out to Jack Lemmon.
Yeah. Jack Lemmon is he's so good in this movie, man. People in sales. So people in sales have studied this movie to be better at sales.
Really? Yeah. That's interesting because I work in sales.
Perfect. Then this is perfect for you. get excited. It is really, really good. So Glengarry Glen Ross next week. Very excited.
Awesome. I'm excited, man.
Yeah.
Well, everyone, we hope you enjoyed part one of our end of season series from Stage to Screen. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and we will see you next week for Glengarry Glen Ross.